Before I got well, I could definitely talk about myself for an hour. Now I practice humility and realize I don't know much, and I continue to learn, which I'm okay with today. My name is Garland, and I am definitely an alcoholic. I'm from Los Angeles, made my way down here. Thank you for asking me to speak, and thank you for having me here. Okay, so my sobriety date is October 2nd, 2015. It is not my first sobriety date. I make that apparent and clear from the beginning because I spend a lot of time these days analyzing what recovery is to different people. I will tell you what it was like, but I will let you know what I mean by that. So I have been a psychotherapist for the past few years, and I'm in my fourth year of my PhD program at the School of Medicine at UC San Diego. I'm specializing in research on substance use. So what I used to think was what was going to destroy my life has created a life for me. And I have clarity, so much clarity, on my purpose today. So I was born in 1979. I was part of the 80s DARE program. Terribly failed program. Part of the fun that I get to have in my PhD program is I get to analyze a lot of the policies that have been enacted throughout the years on substance use and addiction and drugs, and also anthropology of addiction. So what substance use has meant to multiple cultures throughout the history, and how different cultures have defined addiction. Surprise, surprise, most of addiction gets labeled once a society has experienced a major trauma. But anyways, I'll save that for later. So I grew up in the 80s. I grew up in the entertainment industry. From the time I was 6 till I was about finally escaped when I was about 21, almost 22. So I was bred to have alcoholic thinking, I say. I was going on auditions since very small, being judged, lots of having to read the room and people please, depending on what casting directors wanted to see. So if you can imagine being 6 and having to learn manipulation skills very early, you can understand what I mean by being bred to have alcoholic thinking. I therefore, in turn, became very self-conscious and sensitive to rejection, therefore breeding lots of resentment. And eventually, so my first sort of way to learn how to manipulate my anxiety and rejection and pressure to please was through dieting. So, you know, at 6 years old, knowing how to what to eat in order to lose weight within a couple of days isn't really normal. But that was part of the culture. So growing up in that industry and really sort of having the perspective of the black and white, there was really no gray. It was either you got the job or you didn't get the job. You did a good job or you didn't do a good job. At the time, felt exciting to me. It didn't become chaos till I threw in alcohol and drugs. I also deeply believe that my mother is from Colombia in South America, and my father is American. And I grew up during a time, and I see this a lot as a psychotherapist now, and I have words for it now. But growing up in a time, especially during the 80s, when you practice certain cultures in your household or certain traditions in your household, but then you have to go to school and do American things. And so I always sort of felt disconnected in that sense too. Sort of like not quite understanding why things were different at home, like the food I ate was different, the cultural practices and traditions were different, and then going to school and sort of trying to have to fit in with my peers, aside from the fact that I had missed a lot of school when I would get a job. You know, I would sort of just not be around for a month or two if I was filming something. So I always sort of felt quite disconnected and didn't have words for it at the time. So one thing that I want to point out is that when I was asked to speak, they told me that the overall message was keep it simple, which I believe in God shots. And I sort of chuckled when they told me because I was going through rather not simple time in my PhD program. I was in the middle of comprehensive exams, and if you know what those are like, they're not simple. It's 2 hours, 2 days of 8-hour exams, and then a week to write a grant proposal, which in real life, researchers get a team together to write a grant proposal. So that was terribly stressful for me and sent me through a loop. So when I spoke to the lady, she said, okay, so it's called Keep It Simple. And I said, oh, thank you. Keep it simple. Something I, that it might as well have been Japanese to me for many years, because I didn't know what does that even mean, keep it simple. I had lived growing up such a not simple average lifestyle. And as I turned 15, 16 and in that industry, I stumbled upon drugs and alcohol. So it was less about manipulating food and dieting and more about getting, I don't know if we can cuss in here, getting messed up. So, which was awesome. It was totally awesome. And I will not lie about how wonderful it was when I discovered that. So I realized that, like, if I was nervous about an audition or I wasn't really excited about going to set, I would get messed up. And then just sort of everything would blur out, and it was okay, and it was fine. That didn't last too long till people started noticing. And I remember people would say random things like, oh, I think you're, you know, drinking too much, or, you know, and I would get terribly defensive because that was my coping mechanism. That was my thing. That was the way I could get through whatever was in front of me at the time that I couldn't conceivably get through without drugs and alcohol. And like a good alcoholic, I didn't think I was an alcoholic. I grew up during a time when alcoholics, and I hope I don't offend anybody here, but I grew up during a time when alcoholics were old white men with big giant red swollen noses. So you know what I mean. Nothing wrong with it. It's just that's what an alcoholic looked like. And so I was like, I'm young, I'm a girl, I'm attractive. Like, I'm not an alcoholic. That I know what an alcoholic looks like. And so it didn't match up for me. I just thought I was going through a rough period of time. So around 2021, I just couldn't hide it much longer. So I did what I do best, and I totally escaped, and I ran from the industry, and I was like, I gotta try something different. So that's what I did. I got pregnant and got married, because that's what you do, right? And so I met my husband at the time at a bar. He drank like I did. It was perfect. It was a match made in alcoholic heaven. And I got pregnant. I luckily had enough sense within me to not drink while I was pregnant. But this weird thing happened. I stopped and he didn't. And I realized I married an alcoholic. And I thought, oh God, how did I get myself in this situation? So I begged and I pleaded with him, please don't drink, let's create a new life. And of course, like a good alcoholic, he didn't stop. And so I left him. My son was about 3 at the time. And I wallowed in self-pity. I'm 27, how did I get myself into this situation? Oh, I just have horrible luck. I didn't realize that like my brain, my picker was terribly broken. It's when I share my story, sometimes I have these moments of complete, I'm astounded at how blind I was and at how I thought I knew a lot about life and myself and other people, but I was living in a completely different dimension. The dimension where you can't even see length and depth, right? Like the first dimension, where maybe only time is conceivable. And so I left him, and I wallowed in self-pity, and I drank, because that's what you do. And things started happening to me, like, I got a DUI, and I started getting into fights with people when I would get really drunk, and I started sleeping with people that, like, I didn't even really like or care about. I would disappear for multiple days at a time and leave my son with my parents. I started hanging out with people who didn't respect me even more than I didn't respect myself. And meanwhile, I'm telling you these things happened from my perspective now. I didn't realize that I was doing all of these things at the time. I just thought life was really shitty. So I became the lesser companion. And I stayed in that for a really long time until one of my alcoholic friends told me that they thought I was an alcoholic and that I needed to go to detox. And if you've ever been told that you're an alcoholic by a fellow active alcoholic, it's infuriating. It's infuriating. Because at the time, like, I didn't know any of the AA language. I had never even seen this. Actually, that's a lie. I saw this book at a house of kids I was babysitting when I was 12. And I thought, when I saw it, I was like, oh, that's weird. Why do they have that? Because it was like a young couple, and they seemed fine and cool and not old with big, giant, red, swollen noses. So I was like, well, that's, maybe it's a piece that they have, art piece or something. I don't know. I wasn't familiar with any of the language. So I didn't realize that I had become, when you get called out by a fellow alcoholic, you have become, you have crossed the threshold into being the lower companion. Because they're identifying you as the major problem. We're the problem, but you, darling, are the major problem. You need to go to detox. So in some sort of drunken stupor, in 2000, and after my second DUI, I got dropped off at Brotman Hospital in Culver City where the detox was there. I don't know if it's there anymore, but and I asked, please, before you drop me off, I need to have some Blue Moon. Clearly was not planning on stopping, because if I chose Blue Moon, you know I was coming back for more. So I drank my Blue Moon for some reason and got dropped off at Brotman and woke up the next morning in this hospital-like setting. And I think that was the first time I fell in love with being sick, if that makes sense. And I started to identify with this sort of like beautiful disaster identity, which, you know, I don't judge myself for now, because I understand that I needed these processes that I went through in my journey to now. And I loved being looked at like I needed to be taken care of. I loved that people took care of me. I loved that I was in a hospital setting. I loved that I could say that I was sick. I hadn't found the solution yet. I was still in the sickness, in a way. And I started to be introduced to the literature, and I started to read things in here. And I don't know if you know what I mean, but I would start, you know, they had meetings in the detox, and they would start reading like chapter 5. And when I heard people reading chapter 5, I was like, oh my God, who wrote this? Oh my God, this, I could have written this myself. This is crazy. Other people feel the same exact way? I was shocked, shocked that somebody was reading a plain blue book with exactly what I was feeling every single day of my alcoholic, active alcoholic life. I was shocked, I was relieved, and I was scared as shit, because I didn't know what that meant. What does it mean? Like, now, okay, so now I know that this is like a real thing. But now what do I do? And when you tell somebody in new early recovery who is not familiar with the literature yet and not familiar with all the things we do, right, that like become a way of our life, when you tell them, keep it simple, keep coming back, they're like, are you kidding me? What are you talking about? And this is the one thing that I try to remember. The farther I go in my education, the farther I go in my understanding of substance use in general, not just substance use disorder, but just substance use in general, I try to remember that keep it simple sounds very condescending at times for people who have such a deep hole that they're trying to get out of. You know, for us, keep it simple. I've realized that the longer I stay sober, the more, like, keep it simple now means things like, if you have a paper, do one paragraph at a time, maybe do an outline. Like, that's keep it simple for me today. Keep it simple when I was introduced to the program was, you want me to keep it simple, but I have to go to gazillions of DUI hearings. I don't have a car. I don't have a license. I've got my son taken away from me. I'm dealing with social workers who don't understand. It's like, just don't drink. Excuse me? It's that simple, but it's not. And so I try to remember that because a lot of us have the privilege of like understanding what keep it simple means from a very simple life that we live today, in the sense that like we're not digging ourselves out of all of these holes that we've created for ourselves. So I try to remember that, like, although these sayings are so important and connect the dots in so many important ways, keep it simple means different things at different periods of your sobriety, right? It doesn't mean the same thing now for me at almost 7 years than it did in my first 30 days, even in my first 3 years. Right? And this is the call for us as people in recovery, is to remember that like we're constantly evolving. We only know a little. And I try to maintain that humility in the sense that like what I know today is going to be different than what I know 5 years from now. And that's okay. And I also feel as though AA and those of us who are so passionate and so grateful to the program, that we remember that things are constantly shifting. We're learning so much more about this disease. We're learning so much more, and I get the inside scoop, I'm so grateful, in studying research at the School of Medicine, research on substance use. We're learning so much more about how it develops in the brain, how the genetic piece. We're learning so much that I encourage the members of AA to learn those things as well, so that we can stay constantly evolving and strong and accepting of all different stories, right? So back to Brotman. So it was the first time I was actually introduced to the literature and the idea that other people could put words to what I was experiencing. And so this was before insurance covered treatment, which I'm sure you're all familiar with, some of the things that have been going on lately with insurance coverage and patient brokering and making money off of recovery. But the people at Brotman convinced my parents that I should go to rehab. And so my parents said, yes, okay, we will do whatever we need to do to make sure that, you know, our daughter is okay. So I went to a very nice treatment center for 30 days in Pasadena. Mind you, that was the last time my parents ever shelled out money for treatment. I was convinced by the time that I was done with treatment that, like, I'm going to stay sober, and this is my new way of life. And I left at 28 days because I was good and I was ready, despite what was suggested of me. I didn't have a sponsor, didn't go to a meeting after I got out. I had my boyfriend pick me up, who was also not sober. And I didn't last very long, surprise, surprise. And I went in and out, and in and out, and in and out for another 2 years. And that, to me, was the most excruciating, because ignorance is bliss, right? When you don't know the language of AA, when you don't know what your problem is, you are just floating. I knew my problem, and I just couldn't get it. And that was the most painful of this process for me, was pulling together a week, relapse. Pulling together 15 hours, relapse. Pulling together 30 days, relapse. So much so that some of the things that were being said in AA sort of became like, you remember Charlie Brown's teacher? That's what it felt like after a while. And I became convinced that it would work for all of you. But for some reason, it wasn't going to work for me. Everyone else was going to get it figured out, and I was just going to die going in and out and in and out. I wish I could have understood that some of these things that we teach and the language that we use in AA has to be taken quite literally. Literally. So, being honest with yourself. That sounds so nice, doesn't it? Being completely honest with yourself. Like, now I really literally know what that means. Like, it's that little mini conversation that you have with yourself where you're like, oh, wait a second. What's my real motivation behind this circumstance right here? That is literally being honest with yourself. This is what I mean, is that I encourage us, those of us who have a few months, few days, years, those old timers that I respect so much, we have to remember to slow down and remember where the newcomer is at. They're down in that deep, 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 deep hole, that abyss where you can't even see them. And so we have to remember, like, all of these things that we're, like, telling them and we're working with the newcomer, like, we got to slow down and remember. Quite literally show them, literally, some of these things. Because that's where I think I got lost for a long time. I was listening, I was hearing, I was reading, I was doing all the things, but a lot of what I was learning and doing and surrounding myself with, it wasn't a literal thing. So after a few years of in and out, I stumbled upon a place called, and mind you, I stumbled upon this place from a phone call from a friend that I had known from AA for all of those in and out years, while I was sitting in a tent in the middle of the Bologna wetlands, if you're familiar with that area, with a handle of vodka that was half gone. And for some reason, I answered that phone call. And he said, hey, are you okay? What are you up to? I haven't heard from you, blah, blah, blah. I said, I'm all right. By this time, my ex-husband had had my son. I had lost total and complete custody of him. That tent that I was sitting in was given to me by my father when I showed up at their doorstep one day. My mom bawling, my dad saying, we love you, but we can't have you in here. And he handed me a tent, and I left. So I got that phone call. He said, you know, you should really try this place called Beit Teshuvah. I don't know if anybody's heard of it. It's in Culver City. It is a Jewish faith-based treatment program, but they don't push their spiritual practices on you. I called. I said, I don't have any money. I don't have anything. They said, oh, perfect. Be here tomorrow at 8 a.m. 8 a.m., that's really early, especially for a drinker. So I got dropped off. It was the one ride my mom said she would give me. I got dropped off. I didn't have shoes. I had no shoes. I was wearing the same sweat outfit that I had had for many months. And I walked in there, and they kept me for 13 months, no pay. I learned the inside out of substance use treatment. I started doing like tech kind of work, like about a year in sobriety, they would let me like round up the residents, make sure they would go to groups, take census, all those things. And I started to feel purposeful. But I was still in that deep, dark hole. I will never cry quite like I cried in the shower there, and I have such vivid memories. I couldn't stand up. I was holding the handicap rail, thinking about all of the destruction that I had caused. And my son somewhere in the Bay Area with my ex-husband wondering why his mommy doesn't love him enough to stop drinking. And I was heartbroken, thinking about all of the holes that I had to dig myself out of. And that's what I mean is like, when you're thinking about those things, they're so real and they're so painful. How do you possibly keep it simple? Keep it simple. I don't have my son. I have to go to so many court dates. I have to put a blowing machine in a car that I don't even have because of all my DUIs. I have, fines. Oh, I forgot to tell you. Before I walked into Beit Shuva, I was known amongst my unstably housed community as the drunk Goldilocks, because I had discovered that in this neighborhood that I knew, when someone goes to work, they're not home all day. And I was like, I am a genius. I would cut a slit in the screen, slide the window open, hop in there, sleep in their bed, eat their food, drink their alcohol, watch TV, take a little nap. And then around 2, because I didn't want to risk it, I would leave. And I did this for more than I should have before I got caught. And picked up a residential burglary, felony. I did a few months in Linwood County Jail, women's jail. It was a very nice day. So much so that I literally have I have very minimal memory of being there because it was so traumatic for me. And it's sort of like a rite of passage, I guess, because people would be like, wow, you were at Linwood? Who was your bunkie? And, asking me all these questions. And I have so much blacked out memory from those few months because it was just inconceivable for me that human beings live like that and that people know about it, that they live like that. Like it's a system set up for people to live like that. And even that didn't stop me. I left and I got on that bus and went right to the liquor store. So at Beit Shuva, I was thinking about all these things that I had to dig my way out of. And I did what I was taught, which was, one foot in front of the other, one day at a time. Eventually got a job because I had been in the entertainment industry for so many years, I got hired by a company that hires people to do recovery coaching for celebrities. Because they don't have time to go to treatment. So I did that, and that was... I was like, I am a sellout, and this is weird. Because you're there to help someone maintain their recovery, but you realize that their team are just yes people, and you're just there to say that you're helping them maintain their recovery, but it's not actually real recovery. as we know it. So I did that. I managed to make enough money to move up north, be back with my son, get temporary joint custody, and started a master's program there at Stanford. And yeah, and I was like, damn, I'm good. So my master's cohort was like, hey, want to come have a glass of wine with us after class? Because I like only told certain people that I was in recovery. And in my mind, in my one-dimensional mind, it was because I wanted to maintain my anonymity. This is how crazy it is in here. I wanted to maintain my anonymity because I didn't need everybody to know that I was in recovery, so I would only tell certain people. Ironically, not the people who drank. I would only tell people when they were like, oh, I'm a friend of Bill, and I'd be like, oh my God, me too. So they said, you wanna go meet for some wine? I said, yeah, why not, I'm good. I got joint custody, I got my own place, I'm at Stanford, like, shit. I must have outgrown it. Isn't that so fun when you get to look back and go, So I met with them, and can you believe it? I was the one left there drinking wine after everyone left. They were like, oh, we gotta go, we have class tomorrow. But, oh, okay, I'll see you guys. And I just kept drinking. And I drove back to my place, and not for one second in my mind did I go, okay, the progression, picking up right where it left off. About a month later, I was in Oakland jail. I had assaulted a neighbor because I went into their window, picked up right where it left off. It didn't take me but a few weeks to get back into windows and assaulting people and jail. So I was like, oh, I gotta leave Oakland. It's Oakland. Fascinating, right? Fascinating that all of us in here can laugh because we know what that means. I left Oakland. I came back to LA. Same problem. Different area. And finally, again, started with the in and out, in and out, in and out. Went back to meetings. Ah, oh, these people don't know anything. They're just got a job. Would call in late to the job. Mind you, I was working at a treatment center, telling people that I was sober and, like, you know, calling in sick late. They knew it. And nothing miraculous happened, okay? I had woken up on the floors of holding cells, detoxing, lost custody of my son, cried in showers, spent time at, if you want to call it a jail, I don't know, it was like a weird cage of some sort. All the things had happened. And one morning, I woke up hungover as hell. I was going to have my eye opener, ready to call in sick for work. And I just had this moment. And I'm going to cuss once, sorry for those of you. I had a moment of clarity. And my moment of clarity was, oh my God, I'm fucking myself. I am fucking myself. I'm fucking myself. because by this time, like, I was drinking at all of you. I was drinking at AA, I was drinking at my parents, I was drinking at my ex-husband. I was like, fucking everybody. Fuck you. And then I realized I was fucking myself this whole time. And I was like, oh, a good alcoholic has a major ego that says, oh no, I will not fuck myself. This has to stop. And I didn't go to treatment. Mind you, though, I don't undermine treatment. I think I learned a lot of valuable things there, a lot of valuable emotional intelligence there. But I didn't need, I'd done that. I didn't need that. Check my time. Oh, okay. Still got it and talk about myself for an hour. Okay, back to my story. So things shifted for me that day, that morning. Things shifted for me. The things that I could not do before, I did. I realized the people I was hanging out with, like, I didn't even really like them. It's like, no wonder I have to get trashed. I don't even like these people. Can't even have a conversation with them. You know, it was always about, like, what they could offer me. You know, my mind was very much self-centered, selfish. What can you offer me? Oh, you have alcohol? Awesome. Oh, you have a credit card? Sweet. Oh, you have a car? Awesome. It was all about what you could offer me. That day, things shifted, and I was willing to not have a car or a ride or company or alcohol or anything that these people were providing me. I was okay with that. I was okay with being lonely because I had that moment of clarity. And you know, the funniest thing happened. All of these holes that I was trying to dig myself out of, they started assisting me. Things started falling in line. Those struggles felt necessary. Instead of like feeling like a ball and chain, they felt necessary. They felt like, I'll give you an example. I like to work out. Instead of feeling like a really heavy weight, they felt like they were making me stronger, and I wanted to pick up an even heavier weight. I was like, you know what? I can do this. And that I say I entered into that next dimension. There's a part in the big book where they talk about that we enter into a different dimension after that spiritual awakening. And I started to see things as they were, as opposed to through this like alcoholic lens. And fast forward, I ended up going back to get my master's degree. In case you were wondering, I dropped out after that wine episode. Went back to get my master's degree, graduated with a 4.0, got full custody of my son back, started thinking about substance use and addiction in a different way. And I realized I needed to go into a field where I could describe what we read here in that moment of, oh my God, this is my story, to people who don't get it, like researchers and other professionals and clinicians and attorneys. So I have just about enough time to tell you what it's like now. So my son and I have an amazing relationship. We talk very openly and candidly about what it was like and what it's like now. I do not withhold information from him. He's in college now. Yeah. He texts me almost every day. Mother's Day, he said, "I am so proud to be your living legacy." He was one of my biggest silent supporters when I was struggling. That's the one thing. Kids undyingly love their parents, especially when they're young. You are their world. You're all they know. How could they not love you unconditionally? I will never know a love like that, except for what I know with my child. And I thank him even to this day. Thank you for always loving me. Although I know it was not easy at a lot of times. Thank you for always loving me. I want him to know that I know he was always somewhere out there thinking of me and loving me and hoping the best for me. I struggled to get my psychotherapy licensure. The Board of Behavioral Sciences denied my application because of my previous convictions, stated very clearly in their rejection letter, so I am not taking it personally. But that was very painful for me, because if you know what it takes to apply, you have to do 3,000 hours of intern work, and you know, you get your master's degree, you go through a lot to become a psychotherapist. So to get that rejection letter because of my convictions, because of my past, was super painful. But just like that ball and chain that became a weight that strengthened me, I cried a little. And then I said, okay, now what do? I gotta get into the solution. So I was always afraid that I wasn't smart enough. And I was working with a mentor at the time who said, well, then that means you need to apply to the best schools. And I was like, shit. So I did, and I got into this program, because if I had to wait, they make you wait a year to reapply. And, you know, pay for a lot of fancy attorneys to help you appeal your conviction record and all these things. So I had a year to pull that together. So I said, all right, I'll apply to these PhD programs. And I got in. I am by far not the smartest person in the program. Only 4 people get accepted every year. Most of the people that I am in this PhD program with are researchers. Like, we're talking, like, they get excited to analyze data. And they're like, oh, what modeling did you use? Oh, you know, I think I'm going to take this data set, and I'm going to dip it, dip it, bop, 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 bop. And I'm like, whoa. These people. But then I started to realize that none of them know the pain and sorrow and clarity that we know. And I realized that I had a major contribution to science, to researchers, to better understand us. And I realized that that was my purpose, is to bridge those gaps between researchers, clinicians, and us. We all speak a different language Researchers, have any of you ever opened an academic journal? It's the driest, and they will take 10 pages of a simple finding. The results were, black children who grow up in poor neighborhoods are more inclined to use drugs. Really? Could have fooled me. I didn't know I had to read these 10 pages to know that. They speak the scientific community speaks a totally different language. Professionals, therapists, attorneys, they speak another totally different language, both of them. And then there's us, and we speak a different language. And I realized that there were things I was learning in my PhD program that we don't learn in these rooms, which is devastating. Because we of all people should be privy to that information, should not be stuck in an academic journal. Part of the reason why treatment is often very ineffective these days is because none of us are talking to each other. And there's major advancements in science and substance use research that nobody's utilizing. So I found my place in that world. And the more I tried to, I realized that all I really did was keep things simple in their own specific ways. And the more I've kept things simple, the more complex a life I've built. That I have to remember by a person representing a roundup that my talk is about keep it simple. Because we forget. We forget all the different ways that we have to adjust and keep things simple, especially as we build complex lives, right? We get into relationships, we have children, we build careers, we do things. We build things that life becomes so huge, we still have to find ways to keep it simple, just in a different way. And so when I was preparing to share my story, I thought, you know what? How many times is simple listed in the big book? Does anybody know? 29 times. And I thought, oh, that's kind of cool. And I read through the different sections that it says keep it simple. And that's the one thing, and I'm sure we've all heard this before. Whenever I open this, depending on my perspective, I always see something new, something different. Something like that moment where I was like, oh my God, who wrote that? And I've never had an experience with a book like that before. It's the coolest thing to be able to open this up and 7 years later be like, oh shit, that's right. Yes, God, I love this book, God. Amazing. And so I guess my message to everyone is that I encourage us as people in recovery, people in the program, to find new ways to evolve with these messages. Yes, there are core principles and core steps to this program. But part of maintaining what we have is building new perspectives and new relationships with what's in here. And constantly, you know, the one thing that this PhD program has, because I'm a clinician at heart. Researchers think differently, scientists think differently, but I've learned, wasn't easy, but I learned how to take what seems like a problem and establish a way to analyze, explore, accept, and evolve. And that's the one thing that I think science is really cool, because it's like we're constantly learning more. And it's a lot about our recovery, too. We're constantly learning new things about ourselves. We're constantly learning more about our relationship with recovery and the program and the people we're surrounded by and our higher power. And I think at this point, my higher power has, I will admit that when I started my PhD, I sort of lost a conscious contact, which can be easy to do when you're thinking like a scientist. Because everything's about like controlling and manipulating and you know, variables, and that you can easily float out of the perspective of let it go. You can't say that to a scientist. They'll be like, "Are you nuts? Let it go." No, we gotta figure this out. And so I've been called within the last year after my comprehensive exams, after I'm currently in the dissertation process, to come back to my conscious contact with my higher power. It looks different now. I'm now like not on my knees begging for clarity. I'm on my knees saying, "I'm here. Let me, show me the way. Show me what I need to do. I've made it this far. Keep me on the path that you have for me." My specialization in my research is substance use disorder within the legal system. I think it's so funny. I'm one of the only people in the program who's in recovery. I would look at these scientists and I'd be like, "Why are you studying substance use? Like, why do you care so much? That's weird." And for them, it's more about, you know, attacking a problem or the different analysis that they can put to something. And for me, it's much deeper than that. But I have created a training in my legal journeys, especially after the BBS situation and many of the DAs and public defenders that I had to go, that I had to interact with when I was going through my legal issues. I realized they didn't really know what I was struggling with. And I thought, oh, that's weird. I wonder if they have to take classes or anything. And so I got to do a qualitative experiment where I interview attorneys, DAs, public defenders, judges. Mind you, it's very cool to be able to be the authority asking these questions to these people. And they don't have to take any classes in law school about substance use, substance use best practices. I think we all know there's a lot of attorneys in AA. They use substances a lot, very similarly, but it is different, because it's associated with prestige and power and networking and all these things. I got to learn a lot of really cool things about attorneys and their perspectives around substance use. So I decided to create a training that I am using for my data for my dissertation, where I teach them. And I did a presentation, and a very, very, very well-known attorney who now speaks on health and justice policy contacted me and said, I want to work with you. I will give you access to all the DAs and public defenders around the country so that you can do your training and gather data. I mean, I was like, does this guy know I was in Linwood County Jail? This guy's trusting me to contact offices, DA's offices. I've met the elected DAs from all over the country with this guy. So I get to train these people and collect data, pre-training and a post-training survey, to find out what perspectives have changed, what stigma exists, their intended practices towards people with substance use related cases. I teach them about the neuroscience on substance use. I teach them about evidence-based practices. I teach them about treatment deserts and how you can expect somebody, you can order someone to go to treatment, but if they have to take a bus 50 miles away, they're dropping out. All the research shows that they're dropping out. So that's my, that's where I'm at now. I get to create and make contributions to science regarding substance use. And I get to teach attorneys, which is cool. I'm also a professor at San Diego State. Thank you. I teach alcohol and other drugs, problems, prevention, and treatment to future social workers, which is also so amazing for me because I dealt with so many social workers who would tell me, just don't drink, and you'll see your son next week. And now I get to teach them, future social workers, about how to better interact and interface with people with substance use disorder. How to better understand them, how to better reach them, solutions, also harm reduction strategies. So that moment, that spiritual awakening, that, oh my God, I'm fucking myself. I knew what I was capable of. And I'm certain I have so much more to go, but just being where I'm at right now, from calling in sick to work to being able to work with DAs and public defenders around the country, teaching social work students, wouldn't happen if I wasn't willing to evolve. So I thank all of you for reminding me. By sharing my story, I get to remember. And I encourage you all to learn more, to evolve, to grow, to find new ways with these things that we tell each other, like keep it simple. Find new ways. Where can you keep it simple in your life today that you didn't have the perspective on before I came up here? And I wish all of you the best. I'm very, very grateful to be here. I'm grateful for this program. I'm grateful for this book. I'm grateful for the journey. And I hope you all have a wonderful rest of your Saturday. Thank you.